like the others, I'm pleased to be invited to talk here today. The Centre of Hypersonics, we've been going since about... Well, hypersonics in Australia has been going strongly since 1962, when Ray Stalker came back from Canada, where he was playing around with cannons and things, and invented this thing called the free-piston driver concept for shock tubes. High-speed shock tubes have been developed sort of basically since the Second World War, and we needed them in the early days of hypersonic flight, and people argue now about whether we still need them. I strongly am of the opinion that we do still need to experimentally measure things before we fly, and that becomes harder and harder the faster you go. To go fast, you basically need big forces to push things. We get those in shock tubes by using high pressures. High pressures were available at the end of the Second World War because they had all these old gun barrels lying around, and that was a convenient way to get going. Also, to get things to go fast, you need big forces, but it helps if what you're pushing on is very light. The best gas to have, of course, would be hydrogen in that respect as a driver for shock tubes. And high-pressure hydrogen, the high pressure actually makes things get a little bit denser. So your high-pressure hydrogen is going to be even better if you actually heat it up as well as making it high pressure. You imagine high pressure hot hydrogen as a bit of a health hazard. Didn't matter too much in the sort of 50s. They were all World War II veterans. They were very brave. But eventually, they blew themselves all up. There were none of them left. So they had to go to something else. About that time, helium became sort of readily available fairly cheaply. And it turned out helium was just as good. So what you needed was hot, high-pressure helium. And they had many ingenious ways of trying to heat it up, some stupid, some clever. Anyway, Ray Stalker came up with what's really the best idea and has been the standard high-speed driver system ever since, which is what he called a free-piston compressor. It's basically the bicycle pump idea. If you compressed gas in a tube, pressure increases at the same time as the temperature. You do two things at one time. So he developed this system of having a piston in the end of a tube. You fill the tube up with cold helium. You shoot the piston down the tube, rather like a cannonball. When it gets to the other end of the tube, the gas has got very hot, pressure's risen very high. If you have a diaphragm there, that'll burst, push all your gas through. You have a very good shock tube. As I said, that turned out to be the best way to do it, and we're still doing it to this day. Our group is primarily experimentally based, and we're able to do that in a competitive world scene because of these facilities, which started with Ray Stalker, and we're continuing to development of them now. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of our group, try and explain that there's a bit of method in our madness that may or may not be successful. And then I'll talk about what we're doing now and what we hope to do in the future. The first shock tubes Ray built were in Canberra, and they're still there today, T3. There is Professor Stalker. He's got a unique combination of intelligence, common sense, so you do silly things rather than stupid things, and energy to sort of make it happen. So you can do something pretty useful with your life if you work with Ray. This is who we are in the centre, just to give you a brief introduction of my colleagues. The left-hand column is sort of academics and research staff, semi-permanent. There are about 8 or 9 of us there. The important column, of course, is the one on the right, the research students. All us academics, of course, we don't actually work ourselves. We come up with crazy ideas and give them to the students to implement. So we're driven by the research students. Also, we have a lot of help these days from undergraduate students. Two of them are here in the audience. That column would be too big to fit on the board, but just remember it's there. A lot of our work's driven from undergraduate students who then go on to be graduate students. Plus, over the 20-odd years we've been doing this, there's a whole heap more people who've contributed. Just to indicate some of the people and areas. These are some of the characters. Now, as I said, we developed these high-energy shock tubes. This is T4 over on the right here. It's our current biggest facility. It uses the Stalker free-piston combination. The early work they did in these tubes was just for hypersonic aerodynamics. Later on, Ray realised we have the potential for testing scramjets in these facilities. And I got a letter from Ray Stalker in about 1979, saying he'd got this grant to do 3 years research with scramjets, and he reckoned 3 years was just about enough to crack the problem. And so I came over for this 3-year job, which we haven't finished yet. So productivity's not very good in that regard. Ray left ANU in 1977 to come here, and he sworn to give up hypersonics and work on a topic of more local interest, which was the commercial utilisation of bagasse waste from the sugarcane industry. Anyway, he turned out to be a terrible recalcitrant, and he was soon back to his old habits. And by the early 80s, we were looking at scramjet work again. We did about 10 years preliminary work on this from about 1980, when we were looking mainly at fundamental studies, some of the important engineering things that happen inside scramjets, which you've got to understand in order to make the things work. We didn't touch on the engineering problems of making flight vehicles, just try and understand some of the basics. We looked at things like pressure scaling. A scramjet has to go for a wide range of altitudes, and the pressures will change a lot. If we test them in shock tubes, we can't always recreate exactly flight conditions. We have to do some scaling, increase the pressure, put in smaller models, that sort of thing. We had to see if that would work. There's a big demand to run scramjets with as cold an intake temperature as you possibly can in order to make the combustion processes work properly. Of course, if you get it too cold, it won't burn at all. Ignition limits were a big region of study in the first 10 years. We had to look at, we weren't flying things, but we could estimate how much thrust they could generate by putting pressure transducers all around them. So by taking point measures of thrust and integrating them in space, we could predict how much thrust we could get. We couldn't actually measure drag or thrust directly, but we could do some sort of estimates from, you know, other theory as to how it might work as a flight vehicle. We looked at different fuels. We looked at hydrogen. We looked at self-combusting mixtures such as silane, which burns spontaneously as soon as they get out of a gas bottle, which caused us a few surprises. We looked at hydrocarbons, ethane, liquid fuels, building up a fundamental knowledge of how the processes work, what's important in them. We looked at combustion chamber design, how to make injectors. And about that stage, we thought we knew enough, theoretically, to build a scramjet. You know, we could put all these bits together and we'd have something that we could test or maybe fly. Of course, that doesn't include the fact that we'd done none of this from an engineering point of view. You don't know all the problems that take all these independent bits of technology, put them together as one, and expect them to all operate as they would independently, as they do on their own. So we needed to sort of take the next step, which was to do just that, but test that concept in a shock tube rather than flight. And for that, we needed to be able to measure forces. And it's very difficult if you've got a shock tube that lasts for, say, a millisecond of time to measure any meaningful aerodynamic coefficients of it. If you look at, we had models of the orders of tens or twenties of kilograms, forces of the order of hundreds to thousands of newtons, not really big forces, and only half a millisecond to measure them in. A conventional thrust balance in, say, one of NASA's wind tunnels that runs for 8 seconds reaches a sort of structural equilibrium. You push on it, the thing moves back, it strains, and stress, you know, sensors somewhere measure the force, that's fine. But they take seconds or hundreds of milliseconds to work. We can't do that in shock tubes. But what we can do is have a different technique. If you, this is a conceptual idea of some sort of flight vehicle. You flow a rise from the left, forces build up, and they send stress waves through the model, through the support structure, which eventually, if you held it there forever, those stress waves would match what's coming in. But in the transient times, that never happens. But if you do a dynamic analysis, it turns out you can correlate stress measurements made in the support structure with the incoming force. Appropriate calibration is needed, and it's quite difficult. This is actually set up here as a calibration process. You have a mass suspended on the model, cut a wire, transiently unloading it. We can use this dynamic stress measurements here to calibrate the force it just saw. Now, it becomes counterintuitive, this sort of thing, because what you measure actually, in general, looks nothing like what's coming in. Here's an example. The black line on this curve is an input from a flight, constant drag in this case, and this line is the actual signal that comes out. They don't look anything like each other. But if you do the dynamic calibration, a process called deconvolution, you can go from this and reconstitute your input. Some of the practical problems that arise is, first of all, they're strain gauge measurements, which are typically very small signals. They're subject to noise. So the clear black line there is the theoretical input. The red is the sort of experimental noise that comes on top of it. This process exaggerates noise. It basically goes on derivatives. So these little up and down bits have horribly big spiky things. So the pure data you get out is this yellow rubbish here. But it turns out you can actually filter that out. This is the mechanical rise time of the gauge. If you filter at a time scale that's smaller than that, but big enough to cut out some of this noise, you revert to the little red signal hovering over the black signal. Well, that's typical of the sort of accuracy we can get with these things. It may not look very nice, but it's a measurement that's better than having nothing. Anyway, that enabled us to go to that step, putting all this stuff together, testing things in the tunnel that might fly. And there's Ray and Alan's scramjet on a stick being tested in T4. That was the first model we ever used to get more thrust and drag. Okay, that's fine. That little scramjet there, however, wouldn't do many of the missions of scramjets that we want them to do. We want them to have crews generating lift. We want them to be accelerators going into the upper layers of the altitude. Eventually, you're going to want to combine them with a lifting body. This is a student project looking at doing that, also in our shock tube. The basic airframe is integrated with a scramjet box, which is down there, and you need a more complicated drag measuring technique. We use the same basic principle, in that we don't directly measure force, we measure stress waves, but for that vehicle you've got to know at least lift, drag and pitching moment, so we need a lot more components in the system. That was a four component one, which from the figures on the side, you see how the output data can be used to very accurately measure the useful aerodynamic coefficients on a scramjet vehicle that looks more like a flight vehicle. Here's some sample data from that experiment. What we're plotting here is on the horizontal axis the equivalence ratio, or the amount of fuel we're burning in the scramjet, against, and here we have the lift coefficient, which is very important if you're trying to fly one of these and maintain altitude. Over here we have the thrust coefficient. They both change dramatically with the amount of fuel that's coming in, and we're able to quantify that. These are the flat curves along here, using test gas of nitrogen, where the hydrogen, of course, doesn't burn, and these are air flights here. So we can measure the very important coefficients which are necessary to make something fly. The same technology we can use to measure external aerodynamic coefficients. This is a Japanese high-flex vehicle, a re-entry tester, which looks sort of something like the space shuttle, and it's sort of fat and comes back like that. The unknown thing about these is how those little tabs on the back work, a problem they had with the first space shuttle flight and nearly lost it. Well, this has been mounted in T4 with a six-component force balance, and they're able to back out the aerodynamic coefficients quite satisfactorily. The good thing about scramjets, as you're probably aware, is they use oxygen in the air. They don't have to carry their own oxygen. Everything else about them is bad, really bad. Because, for instance, to get that oxygen, you have to stay in the atmosphere for quite a long time, high speeds. There's going to be a lot of air friction drag as you go, and associated with that, there's a lot of aerodynamic heating. Ray's been toying with the idea of how to reduce that for a number of years now, because frictional drag will limit the envelope we can get with scramjets. He's actually found from experiments that if you burn hydrogen in a surface layer around your vehicle, you can actually dramatically reduce your drag. Basically how it works is, first of all, there's a low friction in the hydrogen itself. The other thing it does is by combusting in the boundary layer, you expand the boundary layer, which reduces your velocity gradients and can directly reduce the shear stress at the wall. The effect of a concept could be quite revolutionary. This is an experiment Alan and his student have done, whereby there's a combustor section in the middle there with hydrogen injected along the wall of it, and varying the length of the combustor with the wall combustion, we come up with an optimised combustor length for a scramjet. From a combustion point of view, you like to have long combustion chambers, you can get lots of mixing, but the combustion chamber is the point of highest pressure and drag in a scramjet, so if it's too long, you start losing out from the benefits of having a good combustion chamber. This is a little Meccano set scramjet where you can shuffle around different combustion chamber lengths and measure its drag. Here's some typical results here. Black line along here is the drag with no fuel injection. Blue line is drag with one set of hydrogen injection. And this is the red line is a wall injected hydrogen. See, there's a dramatic reduction of drag, but about a factor of 50%. So these sort of concepts we can test in the expansion tube, and the shock tube, and then later apply them to the design of flight vehicles. In fact, a lot of that sort of thinking and experimentation went into Alan's design of Highshot itself. I won't talk much about Highshot because Susan's going to be talking about that after lunch. Associated with all these experiments is like numerical analysis, or CFD. Mike McCross and Peter Jacobs in our department specialise in that, and this is just a sample bit of data around a three-dimensional cone flow that Mike McCross has generated. Okay, that led us up to testing real shapes in the shock tube, and that went on to the flight test program, which as I said, Susan's going to talk about. That's just a little schematic to picture to indicate the next stage of all this, sort of, is to develop more flight vehicles. We've looked on high shot of the operation of a combustion chamber. We want to look at combustion chambers with thrust. We want to look at combustion chambers with lift, flight paths. There's a whole range of future work we want to do. That will go in parallel with our shock tunnel testing, because we think it's the only sensible way to do it. Okay, that's what we do in T4. It's a reflected shock tunnel, which we've had going since 1987. About 10 years ago, Ray Stalker came to talk to me and he said, you know, my shock tubes can't go any faster, they've reached their speed limit. Why don't you start looking about making them going faster, you know? The T4 shock tube is what's called a reflected shock tube. You heat the gas through a shock wave, it gets to the end of a tube where it stops, all the energy stored in heat, you then get that back to velocity by expanding it through a small hole in the nozzle. To go faster, you need to get that stagnant, you need to put more energy into that stagnant layer of gas, which then gets hotter. Because things radiate in a very non-linear temperature manner, it turns out above about 6 or 7 kilometres per second, which is just suborbital, it's not fast enough to get into space, you can't go any faster because you lose all the heat by radiation. So we were talking to Ray about how we might do this, and of course what you've got to do is get away from this stagnation region stuff. Don't have a reflected shock tube. You can cascade shock tubes in series, and with never stopping the gas, you can continue to add more energy and go faster. So me and Ray discussed that for a while, and he said, yeah, it'll be easy, go ahead and do it. 10 years later, I can tell you that Ray Stalker is a lying bastard. It wasn't easy. It turned my hair grey, and there are other deteriorations in performance I don't want to talk about. But anyway, he was right in one regard. It did work. We were able to go faster. This is a schematic of the latest shock tube we've just built. We call them expansion tubes, in fact. It basically has the same sort of principle of compressing helium gas for the driver upstream to create the high pressure, high temperature stuff which drives the shock tube. And then there's a cascade of tubes in series leading to flow speeds up to about 15 kilometers per second and flow durations of the order of 10 microseconds up to sort of half a millisecond, that sort of time scale. I won't dwell too much on the principles of its operation other than to explain a simple analogy which covers the difference between reflected shock tubes and these expansion tubes. If you look at a reflected shock tube, it's equivalent to if you had a car, say, without an engine, and you want to get it going fast, you can get all your students to push it up the top of a hill very slowly. When they let it roll down, they get all that energy back at once, and you can get the car going quite fast. If you want to go faster, you've got to find a bigger hill, go faster and faster. Eventually, you reach the biggest hill around, that's it. And that's what's happened to T4, or reflected shock tubes. They're getting as hot as they can get, all that energy stored there. There's no way of going any faster. So what we do in the expansion tube is we take two cars up the hill instead of one. They both roll down together. When they get to the bottom, those two cars both have the same speed as the individual car would have had on its own. So you get all your students in the back car to push like hell on the car in front. And if they do it just right, the rear car stops, the front car goes on with twice the momentum, four times the energy, and that's all fine, you can go a lot faster. The problem is, of course, you have to throw one car away, so that effectively means, in shock tube language, you throw away half your test gas. So the test times in these sort of devices are much smaller, because effectively you throw away most of your test gas, and the factor isn't 2-to-1, it's more like 10-to-1. We get about 10% of the test time, but we do go very fast. Okay, this is just a picture of our latest expansion tube, X3. These are some of the sort of models we're testing in it. Why do we want to do it? It's for looking at when you go beyond Earth, you go out to Mars or Jupiter or somewhere like that, you come back with orbital velocity, you know, speeds in excess of orbital, and it's a very different game. Things behave differently. This is an example of some data from some tests we did for Jet Propulsion Laboratory on towed aerobrakes. On the horizontal axis here, we have the velocity. Remember, orbital speed's about here. Well, here we have altitude. These sort of coloured bands here are funny things that happen when you fly. The red thing is oxygen dissociates. Blue is nitrogen dissociating. You go real fast, your flow ionises and radiation starts coming into play, and that makes a very big difference as to how you can fly. So you can see shock tubes run out of steam around about here, and the expansion tube envelope is able to continue. In fact, I think it can go a long way sort of over there somewhere. And so that's briefly how we can get these new test conditions for flight. Some of the things we don't know, you come back as an aerobrake, you need to make it very, very blunt, because that's the efficient way to stop things. If it's blunt, all your force is on the front surface, your weight behind it, it's a stability problem. So we need to look at stability of flows. You're up in the upper reaches of the atmosphere, it's not sort of continuum. You can always count the molecules one by one as they come. Things behave very differently in those sort of circumstances. We need to be able to scale that sort of flow. We don't know how the chemistry behaves. The radiant heat transfer is not well understood. Simple radiation laws are known, but not non-equilibrium at very high temperatures. And the temperatures really are big. You can get up to sort of 10 times the temperature of the sun behind the bow shocks of these high energy flows. It's just unbelievably hot. everything's non-equilibrium, but basic physical things aren't understood. I mean, you can write a code to model it, but no one really knows what numbers to put in the code, so we need this data to prove it. Okay, one project we've got going on involves a new form of aerobrake. The typical re-entry vehicle has insulation over the whole of its front side. The area of the capture area of that vehicle is basically tells you how much area you have for creating drag. If you have a certain velocity change to create, you've got to go down to the appropriate density in the atmosphere to get enough drag. Well, if it's a smaller vehicle, you've got to go much deeper in the atmosphere, the heat transfer becomes much higher. NASA are looking at ways of towing giant brakes behind a re-entry vehicle, and these can be up to sort of kilometers diameter, which are basically inflatable balloons which allow you to just skim the atmosphere, picking up the occasional molecule and losing your heat transfer in a region where losing your velocity in a region where there's very little heat transfer. Some of the figures here illustrate why it might be worth doing. If you just look at the right-hand columns here, a re-entry for various missions of various planets, the conventional re-entry mass shape here, the mass of a volute-type inflatable object here is down typically by about 50% from the conventional. That's the incentive for doing this sort of work. JPL have looked at it at suborbital speeds, and we got a contract with them to test it at superorbital speeds. What we're looking at here is this little sphere at front is a simulated spacecraft. This ring in the back is basically a big wrapped around donut, the aerobrake, and we're taking pictures of the flow in different gases for different missions to try and reconstruct the flow field and see how they'll work. One big problem with these is you have a wake behind the spacecraft, and if you're braking, if your towed brake has to fly through that wake, it'll be unstable. So if you have these things with a hole in the middle, possibly your wake can go through the middle and it'll be fine. A problem with that, though, is maybe you'll choke the flow in the middle, and that's the subject of another research project. Coupled with this stability problem is the need to measure three components of aerodynamic drag. This is what we're doing for, in fact, it's the Pathfinder mission. The Mars Pathfinder was a very blunt capsule of that shape, and it had 2 points during its re-entry of potential instability, where if you have an inclination to the flow, typically your aerodynamic forces on that side increase more than on the other side, and it returns to its stable position. If they are located 2 points on the Mars Pathfinder, actually a 2-degree deflection actually caused the forces to reverse, and it would get worse and worse and would crash. They got around that problem not by reshaping the craft, but by actually spinning it higher. On the flight, as they came through, they did actually, with accelerometers, they were able to measure that instability. Because they had enough spin, they got through it without any problems. We want to be able to measure these things experimentally before you fly. So what we have here is a three-component force balance. So struts are positioned so that we have enough information to pick up lift drag and pitching moment. This is the MUSA C capsule being tested in one of our expansion tubes, X2. This is the Mars Pathfinder at angle incidence, measuring those characteristics. The Mars flew into Mars Pathfinder, of course, was going to Mars, so we had to test that one in carbon dioxide. The MUSA's capsule coming back to Earth, so we tested that in air. This is a picture of our force balance with the MUSA's capsule on the front of it. It's very difficult to measure these forces. The stress levels are fairly low, so you need high gain amplifiers. You need big wide bandwidth in order to get response time high enough. That all leads up to a lot of input noise, and the basic process of deconvolving it is also noisy. We had to protect, and the flow coming through it is ionized because it's going so fast, so there's a lot of electrical rubbish coming in to be picked up. It's very tricky setting it up just right. This one wasn't quite right, so we had to put an extra insulating layer on the outside. What you see here is actually a well-known type of contraceptive device, which turned out to be the most effective means of insulating it. We stretched it over. It was very good. Like most of these things, it was used once only. We had to change it every shot. As far as I can tell, it was the best way of doing it. But I think the sort of lurid purple colour was a bit over the top and sort of kinky. Apart from that, it's quite justified. No. The biggest problem with that, actually, was claiming the money back from purchasing. They just couldn't. We had to subsidise that. These are typical signals. This was a zero incidence condition, where zero incidence, of course, there should be no lift, no pitching moments or lift. That's our zero lift long air. It's got a different axis, and these are the drag components down the bottom compared with aerodynamic predictions. So that worked very effectively. Another interesting area of work is going to the gas giants, which are mixtures of hydrogen and helium. Velocities are very large, up to 50 kilometers per second. We can't go that fast in our shock tubes, but actually there's a similarity. If we fill the shock tube, the gas on Jupiter is hydrogen and helium. If we swap the helium for neon, we can get us at about 10 or 15 kilometers per second. We can get a flow that's mathematically equivalent. So Charlotte, one of our students, did that, and this is an interferogram of a flow past the cylindrical body going through Jupiter gas, and these little shifts in the fringes here, which the physics department do for us, are able to give us useful information about what's happening in the flow. These unknown chemical devices. This is a different shape model going through the same gas about 15 kilometers per second. Part of the extra scramjet stuff we want to do will involve flying with a lifting body. Lifting bodies obviously generate drag, and in hypersonic speeds there's a shape that's been sort of proposed like about 50 years ago called a wave rider, which minimizes the drag associated with one. They've never actually been tested at superorbital speeds before. They've been tested at low speeds. A lot of theoretical work has been done in them, but I won't explain how they work, except that they theoretically give you the least amount of spillage of flow around your vehicle, so you can generate maximum lift with minimum drag. This is one going through air. This is one driving, going through the simulated Jupiter gas. It's the first time we've ever got data of this nature out of shock tubes at these sort of speeds. Another project we're working on is the Mice in Space project, called Mars Gravity. You may have heard of it. There's a lot of data, physiological data, about what happens to humans in 1G. You can live to be 80 or 90 if you live cleanly and behave yourself. If you're out in space, 0G, very quickly you deteriorate. There's muscular degeneration, which can probably be recovered completely by exercise, but bone mass degradation is not fully understood how it'll be. If we go to Mars, there'll be 0.38G applying on the surface. We don't know if 0.38 is so close to 1 that there'll be no long-term effects, or if it's so close to 0, the effects will be the same as being out in space. So this project, which we're doing jointly with MIT and the University of Washington, is to put a payload of mice in space, spin them up for 7 days, I think it is, to generate 47 weeks, to generate the gravity we should see on Mars, and bring them back, chop them up, look at them, you know, and make, by sort of analogy, work out what it's going to be like in space like that for humans. This is a student-run project. We've been invited to do the re-entry recovery and landing. We'd hope we may be able to get it back to Woomera, and our students are designing the heat shield here. And the shape we've used, by the way, is the Discoverer shape, which was invented in the late 50s for American spy rockets, which went over Russia and places like that, took pictures, and then dropped the little film canisters back. And it's done about 500 successful re-entry landings. And so it's a very conservative shape, but a good one for us to make. We hope we're not going to be the first person actually to burn up a shape like this. And that's okay, that covers our research stuff. I'd like to finish with saying a brief word about teaching activities. Our research work is all tied in with research students, as I sort of mentioned, so that's higher degree involvement strong there. We have a mechanical and space engineering degree, which is for undergraduates. A lot of undergraduates get involved in projects, as I just mentioned. So they do thesis projects related to our hypersonics. They do design projects in the same sort of areas. And we had a project recently associated with the MUSES C, where the students design an asteroid disintegrator gun, which is like a little gun with a captive bullet, which you use to knock a couple of grams material off the surface of an asteroid to get your samples to bring back home. And we try and involve undergraduates as much as we can in our research program to sort of add content to their undergraduate degrees. I'd like to stop. Thanks.